You're listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. Hosted by business and political expert Jay Amernick, political visionary and entrepreneur Rick Raddatz, and me, journalist in all media Heather Vail, The Political Fix reveals the answers we're all looking for. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com. Welcome to The Political Fix on this Wednesday, September 10th. It's 9:10. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. Jay Amernick is a strategic planner that helps his clients create and implement plans, goals, tactics, and benchmarks. He also serves as the bridge in Nevada for Israeli companies who want to expand their business in the U.S., and his development labs create smartphone apps and inventions. Rick Raddatz is a serial entrepreneur and internet marketer with a degree in philosophy. His political development is called The Solution, which forms the backbone to this show. And The Solution, as he says it, is to cap and prioritize government spending. I'm Heather Vail, also known as The Unwrapper. I'm a freelance interviewer, journalist, videographer in all media. Welcome to the show, guys. How is your week going so far?
Good morning.
Good morning.
I'm a little, it's tough. We're sort of saying goodbye to summer, and I got to tell you, this was a very good summer. So
it was the summer of Jay.
I was the summer of Jay. I lament it ending. So.
Oh, well.
To see, everything though, right? To our,
you know what though? I think we actually have, well, we've got another 10 days of summer officially. So.
Yeah.
You could
summer
just embrace
ends on Labor Day.
Not technically.
You stole summer.
Not technically.
No, technically it does.
Technically it ends on September 20th.
That's a made-up thing. It doesn't make any sense.
It does, because every season is 3 months. There's four seasons, they're 3 months each. It goes from equinox to equinox.
September, October, December, January, February is winter, clearly. March, April, May is spring. June, July, August is summer. How simpler can it be?
Yeah, well, that's how kids look at it. But technically, the changeover is around the 20th and the 21st of each quarter.
Nah, that's silly. It's silly.
Okay, it's silly. All right, well, let's cap and prioritize that.
Okay.
Let's make the seasons consistent around the world through capping and prioritizing.
Capping and prioritizing is the towards rational thinking, and when the whole world is thinking rationally, that will be the conclusion it reaches. So, in the Northern Hemisphere at least. But there you go.
Okay.
And we do cap and prioritize when the seasons come, because we think about it. People ship their wardrobe. People actually do cap and prioritize. We've talked about it before that it all works on a microcosm. We just have to get it to work on the macrocosm. And then,
but we do not
globally.
We do not do that on September 1st. I have not put away my summer clothes. It's in Las Vegas. It's still 95 to 105 every day.
Right. We're going to be smoky out here till.
Look. If you're going to bring fashion into this, the fashion industry has rules about what you wear after Labor Day.
Not anymore. Okay. You're dating yourself.
My case.
That goes back 50
years.
No, it's
just don't wear white after Labor Day. That's it.
That's in the colder climates. That is not a rule in Las Vegas. It's not a rule in Florida. It's not a rule in California. So, that was created for people who live in, like, Washington State and Michigan.
Exactly.
So what you wear in Vegas stays in Vegas?
No, what you wear in Vegas is irrelevant, as long as it fits the theme of whatever event you're going to.
I think probably true. Okay, let's get on with the show.
All right, so let's find out what cap and prioritize really is when you talk about the solution being capping and prioritizing.
Okay, the whole idea is that we know that our government right now is fiscally unsustainable, okay? Because no matter how much it taxes from us, it wants to give us more, okay? So raising taxes cannot be the answer. Even if you tax everyone who's rich, government will still want to spend more. And so we need to have some kind of cap. But a cap's not politically viable. So the way to make it politically viable is to take what money is left after a sustainable cap and actually prioritize it. Not just argue for it, but actually prioritize it. Rank it from top to bottom, so all the most important spending is on top, and all the least important spending is on the bottom. And what that does is that helps make sure that the people who need help most and the ideas that help them most get priority. And as we reprioritize every year, we'll find better and better ways to use that purchasing power. And if you think prioritizing the budget is impossible, I understand that concern, but there are ways. And just real quickly, imagine if all the social spending at the federal level was block granted to the states. They would create 50 different experiments for how best to prioritize, and then we'd discover solutions. So that's cap and prioritize. It unites the limits the right wants with the pursuit of fairness and social justice, equal opportunity that the left wants.
Okay. Comments on that, Jay?
No. It's as always, but I still go with my analogy of the capping and prioritizing the wardrobe when the season's ending. as more of a metaphor, because we don't actually do that anymore. I mean, yes, I have winter suits and things like that, but I'm not going to break them out until probably January here, quite honestly. I mean,
no,
that's
December.
When it's going to get cold. Yeah,
December.
It gets a little chilly in December. Yeah.
Yeah. You break them out for Christmas time. That's what you do. Oh, yeah, you don't do Christmas. You break them out for Hanukkah. Holiday season. How about that?
Break yeah. No, we season. My people do Christmas. It's just we either have Chinese food or go bowling or see a movie.
Oh, okay.
Because that's what's open.
Yeah, you know,
well, in Vegas though, everything's open in Vegas. So it's a
different
thing.
Yeah, exactly. However, there are still a lot of people who go to the Chinese restaurants. Like I've seen signs on the Chinese restaurant saying, you know, this is our busiest day. Thank you.
Well, that's not here, though. That's
yeah,
that's
no, here. I've seen signs on the Chinese restaurants here. I really have. Yeah, last year.
Oh, because I sometimes I'll go to the buffet, you know.
Oh, yeah.
Which
the buffets
will, have,
are
which will
open.
Have Chinese food, usually. So perhaps.
Buffets.
Welcome
fast
to Jewish
food
Christmas
Fix. Demi's.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right.
Okay.
And that can't be the top story. There's no way that's the top story.
What, fashion?
Heather, what
no,
is the top story?
No, Chinese food is not the top story. No. Do you want the top story?
At this point, I'd love it.
All right. Let's top story. Tonight, President Barack Obama will address the nation to outline an expanded military and political effort against Islamic State militants in Syria and Iraq, possibly including airstrikes in Syria. The president will also urge Congress to quickly give him authority to arm moderate Syrian opposition forces fighting President Bashar Assad. But administration officials say Obama will press forward with other priorities without formal authorization from lawmakers. That could include wide-ranging airstrikes in Iraq and perhaps Syria as well. Now, the president did ask lawmakers earlier this year for a $500 million train and equip program, but the plan stalled on Capitol Hill, and that was the end of that. Other elements of Obama's plan include increased support for Iraqi security forces, as well as military and diplomatic commitments from partners in Europe, the Middle East, and elsewhere. After an hour-long discussion with congressional leaders yesterday, the White House said Obama told lawmakers that he has the authority he needs to take action against the Islamic State militants. The White House added that the president still would welcome action from Congress that would aid the overall effort and demonstrate to the world that the United States is united in defeating the threat. For Obama, a sustained U.S. intervention in the Middle East is kind of at odds with the vision that he had for the region when he ran for president on a pledge to end the war in Iraq, where American fighters ended their mission nearly 3 years ago. The timing of his announcement tonight is also kind of interesting, since it's scheduled in prime time just hours before anniversary commemorations of the terrorist attacks of September 11th, 2001. Germany has decided to send assault rifles, ammunition, anti-tank weapons, and armored vehicles to Kurdish forces in Iraq fighting the Islamic State, breaking with Berlin's previous reluctance to send weapons into conflicts. Now, these deliveries haven't yet started, but last week Germany sent a first plane load of military equipment, including helmets, protective vests, field glasses, and mine-searching devices to Iraq. On Capitol Hill, there was little consensus on the scope of Obama's authority to broaden the campaign against the Islamic State extremists, While some lawmakers say the president has the power he needs under the Constitution, others were seeking a more central congressional role in the effort. And that is the top story. Comments, Jay?
Well, one of the things that I found, most interesting actually is that this policy is now at odds with what he ran on, which is not uncommon of pretty much any president. Especially when it comes to foreign policy, because there's a whole lot of stuff that you don't know about when you're running for president, and you think you do, or you don't care that you don't. Okay, you're just trying to get votes. Mm-hmm. You get in there, the first thing that happens to you literally on your first day in office is you get a briefing from the, I believe it's the head of the CIA, if not the Joint Chiefs of Staff, who say, this is what is going on around the world, this is what we're involved in, and we'll continue to go on until you tell us otherwise. At that point, usually the President of the United States, needs smelling salts because it's a whole different world than he thought was envisioned in his or possibly her campaign platform. So I like that this president, like other presidents, had become flexible when they see the reality on the ground and not sticking to some totally bogus, campaign promise. That's something else people should learn. When they make these promises about foreign policy, they literally do not know what they're talking about. 75% of the time, they are not 100% informed, because they can't be, because it's literally above their pay grade as whether they're a governor, whether they are a senator, whether they're a member of Congress.
Yeah. Okay.
Actually, I'm not sure it's true. I thought I heard, and I'm not sure on this. I could be wrong. But I thought once the major party candidate is nominated, I think they have some sort of threshold for determining the major party. I think they do sing briefings.
Not everything. There's a whole lot going on that they don't know about and will not know about until they are sitting in the Oval Office.
They get the secret presidential book, kind of like in that one movie, The National Treasure or whatever.
Yeah, exactly. the president's book of secrets they get. And that tells them about the aliens, about
Area 51, Kennedy, the whole thing. Here's my take on this. First of all, the story said President Obama will do this tonight. And we don't really know that. That's what we all expect. Usually Obama disappoints on the weak side, meaning you would expect a president to say X, Y, and Z, and he comes a little bit short saying that. And when I say on the weak side, I don't mean that necessarily as an insult or a cut, because I think George Bush, was too strong, for example, and a little bit too aggressive in some of the things he did. And so I don't know what's going to happen exactly tonight until it happens, but I would not be surprised if Obama says contradictory things, because he's done a lot of that recently on this issue, where he says, we will fight until they're exterminated, and then he says we'll reduce them until they're a tolerable threat or something like that. So where we actually come down, I would be surprised if he actually took a firm stance. However, the pressure is mounting for him to do something more than talk. So I think something will happen.
Okay, well, this is what he is expected to address the nation with tonight is based on the discussions he's been having with Congress and what he's already said that he's going to do. So it's not just speculation. It's actually coming out of his mouth. But aren't you the one who usually likes to predict the future? Like, aren't you the fortune teller on the show?
Good question. If you want to predict the future, you have to go by the long-term trends. In other words, it's easier to predict what will happen in 20 years in some ways than what will happen at the speech tonight. Because Obama can make any goofy decision tonight, who knows? Okay, that he's in total control over that. Whereas over the long term, the trends dictate certain things. And it's not so much that I can know what year something will happen, but I am confident that humanity will figure out this cap and prioritize idea within a modern democracy at some point. Switzerland is already pretty close to it. Germany is already pretty close to it. The state of Oregon, with the way they cap and prioritize their Medicaid spending, is actually very close to it. So I predict that some nation, sometime in our lifetime, will discover the power, the social justice power of capping and prioritizing, consistent with conservative limits on government. And then that will start to unite the left and right values in government, and then that's when it starts to work, that's when it explodes. When that happens, I don't know, but that is the future, I predict.
Okay. On that note, let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue this discussion, and we'll also have the inside perspective with Jay Emmernick, so we'll be right back with you on The Political Fix. Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Emmernick and Rick Raddatz. Before the break, we were talking about the top story, which is President Barack Obama addressing the nation tonight. He is expected to say certain things about what he is going to do in Syria and Iraq as far as military attacks. And Rick doubts whether he will actually go through with what the officials are saying that he will say. So we were just discussing.
I'm going to double down on that, because Obama recently got into trouble with his political base by postponing immigration executive orders and such until after the election. And so he is even more in trouble with his base now than usual. And so that's going to further prevent him from doing something aggressive militarily, I'm guessing.
However, he's already been talking to Congress saying that that's what he's going to do.
Yeah, let's talk. We'll see.
Yeah, no, that's right. I believe that the major news outlets actually already have a copy of the speech. It's just been embargoed, which means they can't print excerpts from it.
Right, but they can
write and say he's going to say what he's going to do in Syria, but we can't tell you. They can be vague. They can't be.
On a matter of foreign policy, I seriously doubt that. I bet you they have some talking points and some quotes, perhaps.
But I bet you the
full text is being held back.
Okay, that's quite possible.
And I say that because if something happens between now and the arsenal, we don't want a provisional draft of history being out there in the press, because that would get out. So there's no way that they've given out the full speech, although they may have given out some little tidbits.
Well, the speech itself may not have specifics in it.
The fact is that this is what he is planning to say. So to sit here and say, oh no, he actually won't say what he's planning to say, what he's been talking to Congress about, what he put on the talking points that have gone out to the media, everybody knows what the plan is. You can't just sit here and say, nope, he's not going to do it. He's going to change his mind.
I'm going to triple down on this and say that what Obama is doing right now is setting up Congress. Okay, he's talking to Congress, he's talking tough right now to appear tough, and I think what he's going to do in the speech tonight, this is a bet, okay, this is just a pure speculation here, but I'm going to, that what we're going to do is put the ball in Congress's court, knowing that the Republicans then will look bad for not having their own plan.
Not sure about that, because when it comes to foreign policy and stuff like this, they were very rarely behind closed doors
scorecards. He did exactly that with the Syria red line. He's done this before. So I'm predicting he does it again.
But did the Republicans take the bait? I don't think they did.
I don't know, but a speech is just talk. So he can frame it any way he wants to and then cause the argument to happen. And I think he's going to talk a little tougher than he normally talks. He's got to do that. But I think he's going to kind of leave the ball in Congress's court and ask them for confirmation of a plan or whatever. If that doesn't happen.
However, he clearly said that he believes he has the authority under the Constitution. That was a direct quote, that he has the authority to do what he wants to do under the Constitution. And, you know, it would be nice if Congress was on board, but they don't have to be. That's kind of the gist of it.
Well, I would, yeah. I guess he did that in Libya, so that there are ways. But this is a bigger mess than Libya. With Libya, he could leave from behind. And here he kind of can't. So it'll be very interesting what actually happens.
No, it's But I mean, on the opinion side of it, I would suggest it's, you know, doing something is actually a good idea. I might, you know, we'll probably end up, you know, either fighting them there or here. And it's preferable that we fight them in another country than we do on our own soil. So.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. I thought that, Rick, you would zero in on the part about the $500 million train and equip program that he wanted to do and talk about capping and prioritizing military training programs or something.
When it comes to cap and prioritize with military spending, that's actually not part of the social spending budget. That's a whole different budget. And so in the course of military exercises and diplomacy, you need to have a little bit of a slush fund to do those kinds of one-off operations, without a committee deciding things. So that's totally appropriate, and that's well within the noise of the budget. So that's not a budget busting deal. If it starts a war like he did kind of with Libya, and that goes more than, what was it, 30 or 60 days, I think is the limit, officially. You know, that's where he starts to kind of cross the line. But the president does have a wide range of options to go and do stuff around the world. So. He does clearly have that authority, and we'll see.
Okay, that's a lot of money though, $500 million.
No, it's not a lot of money.
It's
not a lot of money.
It's
okay.
It seems like a lot of money. Like you give me that money, I can do a lot of good with it.
Yeah.
Okay. But but the government needs that money just to do anything.
Yeah.
So,
and
yeah.
Right. And it's like the number one thing the government is tasked with doing in the Constitution. So,
and you know what? Of all the things the government spends money on, the military spending, in all of its ways, is still the best and most effective use of money that we government has. Okay, it's the one thing that there's a lot of waste, but it still performs and even achieves its primary purpose, which is to encourage foreign nations, primarily, and foreign groups to use their resources in alignment with our interests. It doesn't work perfectly, but that's the whole point of diplomacy plus, a strong national defense.
That's right.
Is, hey, don't mess with us, and hey, if you want to, partner with us, you got to kind of step up in these other ways, and in other words, use your resources in ways that benefit us. And so in that way, I actually believe it's important to overspend a little bit on military spending because you don't want to be caught short in that one area.
Yes, and there are also benefits outside of the fact that they, protect and defend us. But the R&D, once it goes from what they call tactical to practical, gives us the laptop computer, it gave us duct tape, it gave us polarized lenses, and a myriad of other things. So we benefit as a society from the R&D of military spending.
Okay. Well, as long as we get our polarized lenses, then everything's cool.
Well, no, that's one example. I try and
actually, no, polarized lenses are cool. They are cool. Yeah, they are cool.
Yeah.
But I don't think you're arguing for this, Jay, but I don't think you can use any of those things as a justification for even a little bit of military action. Or investment or anything. You gotta do what you need to for national security, and just know that there is a little bit of icing on the cake. But that, mm-hmm. that's not something that factors into the strategic decision. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no. And they don't think like this will be great in the household 10 years from now. They're thinking this is going to help us in the battlefield right now.
Everybody needs a vertical takeoff jet.
Well, no, okay, actually.
Oh, now you got them thinking.
Yeah.
Mind. And there are a lot of medical procedures and things like that we benefited from. So it's actually saved civilian lives outside
How the heck could Arnold Schwarzenegger make a great movie like Predator without one of those big machine guns like this with? So there is a lot of value added into even the entertainment industry. It all crosses over.
Yeah. Yes.
Well, we have science fiction. If it's not... If it doesn't exist in reality, science fiction will create it anyhow. So, It's not like we need the military for that.
That's right, but sometimes science fiction spurs on technology and everything like that. The concept of the flip phone flips because of Star Trek.
Yeah.
Not that anybody uses a flip phone anymore, but initially that was the...
Well, 10 years ago, you didn't use anything but a flip phone.
That's right.
I was a Nokia rep back then.
I'm working on my tachyon generator in the back over here. So, yeah, so it becomes science fiction.
Yeah, I was a Nokia rep 10 years ago, and people just kept saying, but you don't have a flip phone. There's no flip phone. It's candy bar. I need a flip phone. So, yeah, and now nobody wants a flip phone.
It's too bulky.
Well,
all right.
What do you mean it's too bulky? It folds down. It's small and teeny, but you can't have it as a smartphone because now people want the screen because they're doing a lot more things with their phone than just using it as a phone.
I barely use mine as a phone.
I barely use mine as a phone too. Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Now, here we go. I'm going to tie flip phones into Cap'n Prioritize. You ready?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Flip phones and the birth of them and then the death of them, and maybe they'll come back someday, but is an example of the competition in capitalism discovering higher and better uses for resources. Okay, we're learning how to use our resources better and better through this marketplace of ideas, essentially. And what Cap and Prioritize does is it forces the same kind of competition to happen within government spending. Okay, so what I'm going to say is that Cap and Prioritize is the social justice equivalent of capitalism. Because what it does is it uses competition to force government to find better ways to help people, the same way that capitalism uses competition to force products and services to get better. And there's no difference except for those two different contexts. One's about economizing private resources, the other is about economizing public resources. And so I want you to imagine what 200 years of social justice evolution within the competitive government marketplace, Cap and Prioritize, will create in terms of ways of helping people down to the very, very precise level. So what I'm imagining is that the government switches over to almost all voucher payments to help certain individuals in certain ways, and those ways go away if the individuals don't step up, or they persist if the individual truly is incapable, and then that's more of a true charity kind of case. So that's what I predict is what we will arrive at after 200 years of this competition.
Yeah, I would also say that doing that will actually increase getting the right charity to the right people because you'll have a better economy. So there will be much less fraud when it comes for people. I threw my back out. I should be on disability or whatever. Yeah. You will have much less of that because, like I said, the economy will be much, much better. It really does solve so many of our problems. And you will always have the people who are truly disabled and who truly, cannot work and will need, and should get the government assistance. The government should certainly ultimately take care of those who really cannot.
And the end result of this, I would argue, is where we have a healthy, competitive nonprofit sector that now has trillions of dollars of funding or the equivalent in the future, all competing in their way to help people better and better and better, improve that so that they get more funding, et cetera, or people choose them with their vouchers. And so that it actually is consistent with free market principles. It's just a different type of marketplace.
The marketplace will change, I think, for the better, because, again, I think Cap and Prioritize will make us think more. It'll make us be smarter. So, we will not be selling the sizzle. We will actually be selling the steak, which is important because, sometimes you buy the sizzle and the steak, quite frankly, sucks. But if you buy the steak, if you're selling the steak and people know exactly what it is, but it's more complicated. That's the issue.
That's what government is right now, the sizzling turd. and they sell the sizzle and you get the turd. I think that's what you said.
You did. You said it tastes like crap. You did.
Did I say crap?
Yes.
I apologize. It's too early in the morning to work blue. I'm sorry, people.
Your idea, the sizzling turd. All right. That's a great name for a radio show, by the way.
No, it's not.
It's a good name for a punk band.
Oh, God.
All right. We're going to take a break on that note. We'll be right back in a few minutes on the Political Fix.
Oh, God.
Welcome back to the Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail here with my co-hosts, Jay Emmernick and Rick Raddatz. And I got to say, if you're not watching the Hangout with the behind-the-scenes video, you're really missing out because we're having some fascinating conversations during the break. One of them was about nude celebrities. One of them was about flaming turds. So, yeah. But we're back. We're back to the show. We're going to talk politics, and in fact, we're going to get Jay Emmernick's inside perspective. Jay has a background working in government, so his segment includes an inside look on the workings of government. So take it away, Jay.
Thank you. This week, this is more of a tactical, strategic concept for us moving forward, and it works in business, it works in anything, but it is simply this: it is pick the low hanging fruit first, which means we steal our allies first, and then they will lead by example. And the best way to work on that, both in government and once CAP prioritizes reality here in the U.S. with foreign allies as well, but it's basically you work from the inside out, and we start with all the moderates on the Republican side and moderates on the Democrat side, because they will be the ones who will say yes. They'll be the ones you'll be able to convince both, and they will have the credibility with their colleagues on their side of the aisle to get them to come over. So you work back all the way to as far right as you can go and as far left as you can go, and then ultimately I think the far left and the far right you may or may not ever get them. I don't know. But then there'll be the lone wolf out there, and that doesn't matter because you'll have the majority, a consensus of the majority, and the majority of the country will be behind CAP and prioritize. And that's how it's going to work, obviously, once it's reality here. We move to foreign countries. We're going to go to our closest allies and liberal democracies, Great Britain, Israel, Germany, who are already
Canada?
On the way. Canada, yes. Canada's actually going to be an interesting one because they I don't know if they're so much on the CAP side of it, but we'll see. The idea is we're not going to go to Mozambique or wherever first.
Okay, well, in reality, there's always a CAP.
Not really, because they because they can always print more money.
They don't just print money.
I didn't say they do. I'm saying they can.
No, but
they've done it here, and they did it in what was the country? One of them. It was like a $10 trillion note from not Tangiers. Where was it? It was an African nation, but it literally wouldn't buy you a cup of coffee because they just kept printing money. It became useless.
They make it worthless. Yeah.
Right, but I'm saying that's what government can do.
Okay,
it's clearly not a good idea.
Canada doesn't do that. There's a cap. There's always a cap. You have to have a cap.
Of course you do.
In reality, I think cap and prioritize already exist, to be honest. I don't think the government can run without doing it.
No, they can and they do. They don't because it's they don't prioritize because they just throw
they
it
do.
On.
They do.
They just throw another bucket of it on the heap and then just add to the deficit.
They do prioritize because people who want Medicare, Medicaid, people who want any kind of welfare, they have to apply. They have to go through a process. It's not just randomly willy-nilly thrown out to everybody. It's prioritized. And it's capped. It's capped and it's prioritized.
It's capped until they realize, oh my God, we don't have enough and we have all these people who need it. And then they'll add more. Most government agencies, the way they work is use it or lose it. So at the end of the year, when their budget comes through and they're like, oh my God, we didn't spend 20% of it. Let's quickly spend it on something stupid and then ask for more money next year. Or if they decide, there's actually no need for us anymore. You'd actually be surprised to know the government actually still pays. And I can't remember where it is, but they literally still pay for the Pony Express somewhere. They will not let any government agency die. It doesn't matter whether they're literally.
Are you sure they're not just filtering that into the United States Postal Service?
They are, but the Postal Service is still spending some money on the Pony Express somewhere. I don't remember. I read. I can't remember exactly where it is or where or how it's done.
Maybe there's a museum. Maybe there's a Pony Express museum.
No, there's no. No, it wasn't a museum. It was like some place that, you know.
Okay, all right. What do you think?
Who, me?
Yeah.
Yes, you.
Well, you know, I would like to disagree with Jay always if I can, because that makes for better radio. And sometimes I do agree with Jay. But this time, I'm not sure what the hell he really said there. I'm just totally confused.
I said you. No, were
I'm exaggerating a little bit. Okay, if I got your point, Jay, it's that we need, if we want to have Captain Prioritize happen, it's going to happen because the moderates step up at some point. And I step up, both extremes get what they want, even if they don't know it right now, and then we end up in a happier place. But it's that's the way you're predicting this happens. Is that correct?
Yes. Well, not only that, what actually makes this novel is that usually moderates don't really take a big, big stand on a lot of things. They're usually not the ones on the floor of the House of Representatives or the floor of the Senate making these grand, big speeches about anything, unless they're in a leadership position. So, and very rarely do they get in a leadership position because of that. So this is actually a movement that's going to...
Yeah, the times when the moderates finally do have political power is always, and it happens very often actually, but it's when the two extremes have locked themselves to extreme positions and they're not going to budge and the country is held hostage. The debt ceiling debate is a good example of that. And then, you know, the gang of 11 or whatever number it is at that time comes in. They're the moderates. Typically, there's a few extremists that kind of go in there to kind of make sure that they're not being stupid about it. But that's the group that ends up negotiating the ceasefire.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's not with a decision, but that's when moderates have a chance, okay? And notice that it doesn't require another political party. And that's why we don't need 100 million moderates to unite behind Cap and Prioritize. We need the academic community to figure it out. We need the think tank community to figure it out. And we need like a million moderates to come together and say, hey, this means to us. And then size, we'll see that momentum. The moderates in Congress will see it too. And the next time they end up being in the middle of negotiating, maybe that's what they propose. It could be a baby step, like what they end up proposing is a blue ribbon commission to study Cap and Prioritize. In the meantime, we'll do this. And that's kind of what happened in the last debt ceiling debate with the sequester, as it was called. So that adds a very light scenario, and I agree with Jay. Now, Heather, to your point that you think government's already doing Cap and Prioritize, I can see why you think that, because – you know, clearly there's some limit. You know, I mean, yeah, you can print up trillions of dollars, but the countries don't do that unless they've already made other mistakes. However, the limit right now in America, at least, is when moderate lefties start to vote for Republicans because they think the government's gone too far on the spending side, then clearly government has gone too far on the spending side. But the problem is that constraint on government spending has too high of a threshold. So that's actually why government is always spending more than it takes in, except when the economy is so overheated that money comes in faster than they can spend it, which happened in the 90s barely. So I'm going to say that where was I? I lost my train of thought.
You were explaining because I said that there's already capping and prioritizing because there has to be.
Yeah. So I'm going to say, yeah, there's a kind of a cap. There's some pressure on how much you spend. But the kind of cap that we need is a cap where there's so much agreement across the political spectrum that, yes, we need that cap, that we stop arguing about how much to spend and we start arguing about how well to spend it. And that's actually what happened in Canada. About 10 years ago when they reformed most of their entitlements, everything but health care essentially, they ended up saying, look, we know we need to be fiscally sustainable. Let's agree on that, left and right. And now let's figure out how best to spend it. And they decided to not spend it at the federal level there, but to delegate it to the provinces. And actually, they gave the provinces amazing free rein to do whatever goofy thing they wanted to do, and it's kind of working. Okay, so no, that's a good thing. So Canada actually essentially has adopted Cap and Prioritize with all of their entitlement spending besides health care. Now, in terms of prioritizing, some of our government's money at the federal level is prioritized and some of it isn't. the Pentagon's spending, all the military spending, largely is prioritized, and that effort is mainly led by the Pentagon, kind of overseen by Congress. Then there's the discretionary spending, so-called, because all spending really is discretionary, but the discretionary spending is divided up among, 12 or 13 different subcommittees, and each subcommittee is given a budget, and that they prioritize within their within that budget. They don't publish the priorities, and that's important to cap and prioritize because it's the transparency of a prioritized budget that forces the best stuff to happen. And the area where it's most important to cap and prioritize is actually the areas where it's hardest to, and that's in the social spending. Because, you know, it has its own momentum. It's a political nightmare to even discuss it. And so we have to have kind of the idea out there in the public first. Then we can tackle this big, you know, giant of a problem. And some of the spending is based on need. And so the merit-based, the need-based spending, I forget, they call it means testing. Some of that is essentially a form of prioritizing, but notice how locked in it is. Okay, it's very chunky. It's hard. You know, these are promises essentially made to people, and people don't want their promises taken away. Under a truly capped and prioritized budget, there are no promises anymore. There is kind of a collective promise that we're going to be using this money in the best possible way. That's a collective promise to the collective. But there are no promises to individuals under a pure implementation of cap and prioritize. There's just the knowledge that if you truly need help, somehow it'll be there, but you don't want to be that bad off, so you're going to try your best and be productive. That's when cap and prioritize is mature.
Okay. However, I'm going to disagree on the healthcare in Canada not following that model, because first of all, it's also provincial. Secondly, there have been caps and priorities put into place over the years. For example, 15 to 20 years ago, it used to cover chiropractic care and eye care, as long as it was with an ophthalmologist and not an optometrist. And then slowly they took those things out. I said, okay, no longer is the healthcare going to cover chiropractor. No longer is it going to cover these sorts of things with eye exams. It's only going to cover this. So they're constantly tweaking and capping and prioritizing what the healthcare, the universal healthcare covers. So,
okay. Yeah. So, the next step beyond that, I'm thinking a little bit more towards the ideal, and that's not always the right thing to do, but the next step beyond that level of cap and prioritize would be where they start switching to vouchers. And so they have a private healthcare industry.
There is a private healthcare industry, though, because the healthcare in Canada only covers the basics, and it only covers certain types of doctors. If you want premium care, you still have the option to pay for it.
I hear you. What I'm saying is that there is only a private healthcare industry. There is no public equivalent, not even for the little stuff. But what is done is funding through vouchers for all that stuff, that people can pick their own healthcare plans on the open market. And through competition, we find the highest and best use of all of those resources. So I do agree with that the Canada is moving in the right direction. And it's better than the U.S. in some areas and worse in other areas. But I do agree it's moving in the right direction.
Okay, cool. So let's take a final break. And when we come back, we're going to hear Rick rant about something. We'll be right back with Rick's rant on the Welcome back to The Political Fix. I'm Heather Vail, here with my co-hosts Jay Amernick and Rick Raddatz. And as promised, we're going to hear Rick's rant now. This is what we call affectionately the outsider perspective, because we already had the insider perspective with Jay. Now we're going to hear what a complete outsider to government intricacies has to say. And it's always interesting. So take it away, Rick's rant.
You know, I think I need a song like on the Late Show, or where they have like they have the little bits, and they have like a little bit of music that goes along with the intro to that little segment.
Do,
I think
do,
I need like
do,
a Rick rant
do.
Theme song. No, not that. Yeah, whatever. Okay, my rant today is about something that's going to happen in 2 days. Okay, 9/12 has nothing to do with 9/11. Okay, this is 9/12, and on 9/12 there's a movie coming out called Atlas Shrugged Part 3, okay? And so they don't have a whole lot of budget to promote this film, at each time, you know, this is part of the time on, they've had to hire less and less expensive actors because their budget's gone down. So I don't know where they got this cast from. But to whatever extent they have, all of these people who believe in the Atlas Shrugged philosophy of a woman called Ayn Rand, some people call her Anne Rand, but it's Ayn Rand. The people who believe in this philosophy, they call themselves objectivists, okay, because they believe they have an objective view on human conflict and how to properly structure it. And basically, they think capitalism is the thing, and anything you do beyond that is theft. And so the government is largely theft, and it should just protect us from each other and maybe from foreign countries and have some courts, and that's it. Okay? That's their ideal. And so my rant is these objectivists are so confident that they have the right answer, the ideal answer, and they're making the same mistake that communists make. Okay? See, all capitalism can do is properly structure, or attempt to properly structure individuals trading with other individuals. You know, don't steal, trade. Okay? You know, that's what capitalism does. It's about individual resources or private resources. And that's not the only moral system that exists, because individuals act in other ways. Individuals vote. Individuals seek political power. Individuals are all over the rest of the world causing problems for us. And then there's future individuals that we care about, too. And so there's all these other ways in which individuals make decisions, or that we care about individuals, that capitalism itself doesn't solve. And the objectivists don't get this, not at all. That's why we have to not just do capitalism. We also have to do democracy or some form of it. We have a constitutional compound democratic republic. And we have to do national defense and diplomacy. And the objectivists get that, but they kind of view that as kind of this other thing besides capitalism. Really, it's all the same thing. It's all about preventing force. But we also have to figure out how to stop voters from abusing their force. Voters have force. And the objectivist answer is that voters should just be educated. They should be smart enough to know not to vote for government to do these things. But since when does educating individuals to act better work? That's what the communists think can happen. We can educate people to act better in production and replace capitalism. No, you can't educate people. Imagine if you tried to educate politicians so that they'd act better, thinking that education alone could work. Or imagine thinking we could educate foreign nationals, ISIS members. We just need to educate them more. They're not educated enough. They'd act better if only they were educated. That's silly. So why would an objectivist think that you can educate voters? It's insane. This is my rant here. It's insane, okay? The way we have to handle voter ambition, voter force, is the same way we do with capitalism, democracy, and defense. We have to set limits, i.e. a cap. And within those limits, we have to have some sort of competition, in this case, a prioritized budget. And capitalism is a free market. In democracy, it's about free speech, where ideas compete. In defense, it's about diplomacy, where we make our needs transparent to our allies and our foes. And so cap and prioritize is the philosophical peer of capitalism. And yet objectivists would smell social justice, being pursued by the government, and they'd run away from it and deny it, and they're absolutely wrong. And this is all about what's happening on 9/12, Atlas Shrugged Part 3.
Okay. Jay, did you see Part 1 and Part 2?
No, I mean, I've read the book. It's almost like the 1984 of capitalism in its own way. I think Ayn Rand is quite articulate, quite brilliant, quite interesting. You know, I don't agree with her obviously on everything, but I agree that the movie has like sort of from what I've seen, less and less people are seeing it, and I mean the book itself is like a 1,000 and some pages or something. She was it's not the kind of thing I'm going to jump into and read again. But this goes, we've talked about this before, about sort of ideologues going too far and doing this zero tolerance thing. A lot of the objectivists believe that all the roads in the United States should be privatized. So you pay a toll if you want to use it, or water. it wouldn't be a public utility. You'd have to like go to some, you know, basically, the, you know, we've been down this road before. This is you know how we ended up with these like robber barons. You know, they're gonna hold the world's resources and they're gonna make you pay through the nose for them. I mean, it's a very, you know, that when they take it too far, it's a very bad idea. I mean, I agree with Rick that they.
Hey, Heather.
Yeah.
Heather.
Yeah.
I have it for you.
Okay.
So I do this whole emotional rant thing, you know, I go rah, 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 rah for many minutes.
Yeah.
You know, and then after I'm done, what do you do? Say, hey, Dave, have you seen that movie? No, the response to a rant, yeah, or something.
I just answer the questions. that I'm asked by the unwrapper. I know better than to defy the unwrapper.
Yeah, no, well, okay, let me ask you though. Is it because my rant isn't powerful enough, or I mean, is it my fault?
Is it God's sake.
Yes, it's your fault. It's Aww. Your
Heather.
Well,
is Heather ranting against your rant?
No, I don't rant. I usually don't rant.
Okay.
However, I was thinking, you know, like I know a lot of people who think that she is just a goddess, pretty much a political goddess. And, you know, when the first one was
Which
coming out, they were
an
talking. They were talking about, oh, the first one, the Atlas Shrugged. Yeah, I can't wait to see it. Oh my God, everyone has to go see this movie. And I honestly, I didn't even hear about part two. I did not know there was a part two, which is why I asked that question to Jay. It's like the whole rant, I'm sitting there thinking, they're on part three? Okay, I did not know
yep.
that.
and they're thinking about doing a TV miniseries to kind of reboot the franchise.
Oh, dear.
Oh, are they going to fund it on Kickstarter?
They actually did fund the marketing on Kickstarter for this.
Did they
third,
really? I was joking.
So, yeah.
I was seriously
yeah.
joking.
No, they did. They raised $250,000.
Okay. Well, that kind of yeah. makes sense. But yeah, I was just thinking of, yeah. you know, Veronica Mars and some other indies like that that wanted to reboot series. So. Yeah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I'm actually meeting next week in D.C. with one of the two leading philosophers in the objectivist camp. When Ayn Rand died, this kind of split into two competing factions. One says objectivism is exactly what Ayn Rand said it is, and it's a closed system. We might discover new things on the edges of this belief of this body of knowledge, but you know, objectivism is what Ayn Rand said it is closed. And the other camp, the smaller camp, says, no, objectivism is about using your brain, about thinking about the objective world, reason, and so we should never stop thinking. We should never stop changing our assumptions, and our goal is the pursuit of the truth, wherever that leads us. And I actually believe in that second one. I think all people of all political persuasions should pursue the truth wherever it leads them. I'm meeting with that open objectivism, it's called, camp in D.C. next week. And so we'll see if I can, under the rant, essentially, in a more calmer way, but see if I can break his argument by his assessment.
Okay. So we're out of time for this show. However, next week we're going to find out what happened when Rick ranted, and we're also going to find out if his... if his prediction was correct about what Obama is going to say in tonight's speech, or what, more specifically, Obama will not say in tonight's speech.
And
so,
what's going to happen with September 12th.
Yes, yes. So check out politicalfixradio.com. Check out our archives there. We'll be back with you next week. On behalf of myself, Jay Amernick, and Rick Raddatz, have a fantastic week, and we'll see you same time, same place next week.
Thank you for listening to The Political Fix, the show that investigates a political solution combining the best of the left and the right. On behalf of Rick Raddatz, Jay Amernick, and myself, Heather Vale Goss, we're glad you chose to get your fix with us. We need reform to fix this country, and incentive reform is what will make a difference. The five economies and resources laid out in Pentonomics and the strategies we call cap and prioritize are the focus of Rick's vision of the optimal political future. Every week we talk about the answers we've dug up among ourselves and with political experts who have the ability to make change happen. Get on board and get your fix. Streaming live Wednesdays at 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern at politicalfixradio.com.